tall, stout poles with hundreds of blooms, and then on those small apple trees, always pruned down, the wonder of the fruit swelling in the autumn, touched in that cool season with the warmest tints, and looking like the apple trees in a children's book, or a school book, seen long ago. At the back of his cottage, the back being where the true front now was, the true entrance from the driveway, there was a greenhouse. It looked like the greenhouses advertised in newspapers and magazines, and might have been bought by mail order. In this greenhouse, resting on a concrete base, oddly level and new and formal in the open littered ground between the old farmyard and the cottages, littered with cottagers' stuff as well as with the farm debris of years, and not far from the ruined old pens where sick cattle and calves were sometimes kept, trampling their own dung into moss-covered black earth, in this greenhouse with its straight lines, new wood and clear glass, Jack grew the over-cultivated flowers and plants of the English greenhouse, the extraordinary fuchsias, for example, which were thought to be so pretty. So many things to look after, so many different things to grow at different times. Jack, it seemed, was looking for labour, looking for tasks, seeking to keep himself busy. And then it came to me that more than business, the filling of the day was involved, and more than money, the extra money Jack might have made from selling his plants and vegetables. It seemed that in that patch of ground, amid the derelict buildings of a superseded kind of farming, fewer and less efficient machines, many more human hands available in this county of Wiltshire, known in the last century for the poverty of its farm labourers, Jack had found fulfilment. My wonder at the satisfactions of his life, a man in his own setting, as I thought, to me an especially happy condition, a man in tune with the seasons and his landscape, I wonder turned to envy one Sunday afternoon when, going out after lunch for my walk, I saw Jack's little car bumping about towards his cottage along the wide, rutted driveway, and not doing the more usual thing of coming down the paved lane beside the windbreak. He had been to the pub. His face was inflamed. His shout, when he saw me, and he seemed to lean out of the car window, was wonderfully hearty. Sunday. But why had he chosen to turn off at the grassy driveway? Why hadn't he driven the half a mile or so further up to the more usual way in, easier for his car, the paved though broken lane that led straight up the hill to the new barn and then directly down to the cottage? Was it drunkenness? Was it his wish to bang about the driveway? Or was it his fear of the narrow road winding on a ledge above the sharp drop down to the river, with two or three blind corners? It was probably in his own mind his Sunday drive, the climax of the extended pub hour, the pleasures of beer on a Sunday. They were like the pleasures of work in his garden as a free man. Here was an unchanging world. So it would have seemed to the stranger. So it seemed to me when I first became aware of it. The country life, the slow movement of time, the dead life, the private life, the life lived in houses closed, one to the other. But that idea of an unchanging life was wrong. Change was constant. People died. People grew old. People changed houses. Houses came up for sale. That was one kind of change. My own presence in the valley, in the cottage of the manor, was an aspect of another kind of change. The barbed wire fence down the straight stretch of the driveway, that also was change. Everyone was aging. Everything was being renewed or discarded. Not long after I got to know the manager's run, change began to come to it. The elderly couple in the thatched cottage on the public road, a cottage with a rich rose hedge, left. In their place came strangers, a whole family, town people, I heard. The man had come to work on the farm as cowman or dairyman. Dairymen, their labour constant and unchanging, seeing a large number of cows through the milking machines twice a day, every day, were the most temperamental of farm workers. Some of them were even itinerants, wanderers. The new dairyman was an ugly man. His wife was also ugly, and there was a pathos about their ugliness. Ugliness had come to ugliness for mutual support, but there had been little comfort as a result. It was odd about change, There were so few houses in the two settlements that made up the village or hamlet that because the road was not a place where people walked, because lives were lived so much in houses, because people did their shopping in the towns round about, Salisbury, Amesbury, Wilton, and there was no common or meeting place, and because there was no fixed community, it took time for change, great though it might be, to be noticed. The tall beeches, the oaks and chestnuts, the bends and shadows in the narrow road, the blind curves, the very things that made for country beauty also made for something like secrecy. It was this feeling of being private and unobserved that made me, at the time of my own arrival, give false replies to questions from people I later knew to be farm workers or council workers. But they had been friendly, interested. They wanted to know in which house I was staying. I lied. I made up a house. It didn't occur to me that they would know all the houses. I had barely got to know the elderly couple who had lived in the thatched cottage. I knew their cottage better. It had struck me as being picturesque. It was narrow and pink-walled. The thatch was kept in place by wire netting. Part of the thatch below the dormer window was brilliant green with moss, and on the ridge of the roof there was a wire-framed figure of a reed or straw pheasant, something I saw, originally a bit of Thatcher's fantasy, now a more general decorative feature, on many houses in the locality. With its privet and rose hedge, hundreds of small pink roses, the pink cottage had looked the very pattern of a country cottage. It was only now, with the departure of the old couple, that I understood that the country cottage effect of their house, and especially of their hedge and garden, had been their work, their taste, the result of their constant attentions. Very soon now, within months, the garden became ragged. The privet kept its tightness, but the rose hedge, unpruned and untrained, became wild and straggly. The story about the new family in the cottage, picked up from certain things said by Bray, the car-hire man, their near neighbour, from other things said by the people who looked after the manor, and from words occasionally spoken on the afternoon shopping bus that went to Salisbury, the story was that the new dairyman and his family had had a rough time in a town somewhere, and that they had been saved by coming to the valley. The man was tall, young, with a long head, thin haired, with a heaviness rather than a coarseness about his features. He had the face of a man who had endured abuse, but it was still a young face. His wife looked aged. Whatever it was the family had endured had marked her face. She could have passed as his mother. Where his face and head were long, she was square-faced, and her square face was crushed, wrinkled. She wore rimless glasses, an unexpected attempt at style. She was withdrawn. In time, smiles came to her husband's face, but I never saw her smile. What terrors must there have been in the town for them? How could people like these, without words to put to their emotions and passions, manage? They could, at best, only suffer dumbly. Their pains and humiliations would work themselves out in their characters alone, like evil spirits possessing a body, so that the body itself might appear innocent of what it did. This couple had two children, boys. The elder had something of his father's abused, put-upon look, but there was about him an added touch of violence, of mischief, of unconscious wickedness. The younger boy was more like his mother. Though he was very small and neat in his schoolboy's grey flannel suit, he already had something of his mother's distant, withdrawn air. There was a bus that, leaving Salisbury in the early afternoon, served as a school bus for the little towns and villages just to the north. It picked up young children from the infant schools in one direction, and then on the way back it picked up bigger children from the secondary schools. This bus picked up both the dairyman's boys. I sometimes used the bus myself. Life in the valley being what it was, this gave me my closest look at the boys, and I began to feel that though the boys might have been saved by the valley, as people said, the ways of the town pressed on them still. The older children, though noisy, were generally well-mannered. It was their custom, when the bus was full, to stand and offer their seat to an adult. Rebellion with them sometimes took the modest form of delaying the gesture. The dairyman's elder son added another tone or mood to the school bus. Noisiness became rowdiness, and one day I saw him not only refusing to stand, but also continuing to keep his feet on the seat beside him. He was embarrassed when I got on the bus. I was a neighbour. I knew his house and his parents. but he was also among his friends, and he couldn't let himself down. The bus dropped us both off in the shade of the great manor yews near his house and mine. I said, "Peter." He stood to attention, like a cadet or a boy in a reformatory, threw back his head and said, "Sir," as though expecting at the very least a slap, and at the same time not truly intending apology or respect. In that reaction, which made me nervous, I felt I had a glimpse of his past, and saw his need for aggression, his only form of self-assertion. I didn't know how to go on with him. I didn't particularly want to. I didn't say any more. He was odd man out on the bus, and like an intruder in the village. In fact, there were no other boys of his age around. People with growing families tended to move out, and though there were a number of young children, the dairyman's younger boy was also a little strange. Among the children from the infant schools on its route, the school bus picked up two or three near idiots. The dairyman's younger son, delicate and small, attached himself to one of these. A fat little boy, thick-featured, with a heavy round head, a boy dressed in startling colours, bright red, sometimes bright yellow at other times, with pale blonde eyelashes and eyebrows that oddly suggested someone dim-sighted. This fat child was restless on the bus. He moved from seat to seat and, as though knowing that the constrictions of school were over, spoke insults casually through his thick, wet lips at people on the bus, innocently spoke obscenities, in a tone of voice which permitted one to hear the older person from whom the words had been picked up. This was the friend of the dairyman's younger son. They were being saved by the job, their life in the valley that so many people wished to live in. But they stood out, and they were wrecking the garden of the pretty pink cottage they had taken over. It wasn't, as with Peter on the bus, a wish to offend. It was ignorance, not knowing, not beginning to imagine that the way they lived at home could be of interest to anyone. Part of their new freedom was the country's secrecy, the freedom from observation, which, like me at the beginning, they thought they had found in the dark, empty road and the big, empty fields. Out of that freedom, that new, ignorant pleasure in country life, some curious gypsy or horse-dealing instinct came to the dairyman. He bought a run-down white horse and kept it in a small field beside the public road. The animal was a wretched creature and was made more wretched now by its solitude. It had soon cropped the grass of its small field right down. It was spiritless, idle. People on the bus commented on its state. And then something else occurred to make the dairyman talked about. His cows broke loose one evening. They wandered about the road, trampled over fields, a few gardens, and the lawn of the manor, in front of my cottage. And then one day, again in front of my cottage, down the path on the other side of the lawn, the dairyman led a hairy brown and white pony, thick-legged and thick-necked, to the paddock at the back. And there, one afternoon, after school time, the dairyman and his son Peter gelded and mutilated the pony, and then they led the bleeding animal back past the windows of my cottage to the white, wide gate, past the churchyard, to the dark lane below the yews, and then to the public road. Did they know what they were doing? Had they been trained? Or had they just been told that the gelding was something they should do? I never actually heard, but I believe the pony died. It was the cruelty of a man who looked after animals. Not absolute cruelty, more a casualness, the attitude of a man who looked after lesser, dependent creatures, superintending the entire cycle of their lives, capable of tenderness, yet living easily with the knowledge that though a cow might have produced so many calves and given so much milk, it would one day have to be dispatched to the slaughterhouse in a covered trailer. Cows and grass and trees, pretty country views, they existed all around me. Though I hadn't truly seen those views before or been in their midst, I felt I had always known them. On my afternoon walk on the downs there was sometimes a view on one particular slope of black and white cows against the sky. This was like the design on the condensed milk label I knew as a child in Trinidad, where cows as handsome as those were not to be seen, where there was very little fresh milk, and most people used imported condensed milk or powdered milk. Now, not far from that view, there was this intimate act of cruelty. The memory of that mutilated, bleeding pony still with the bad-tempered toss of its head and mane, being led to the white gate below the yews by the two big-headed men, father and son, was with me for some time. They had been saved, that town family. Was it Bristol they had come from, or Swindon? How fearful those towns seemed to working people here, and fearful to me, too, though for different reasons. But their life in the country was not as secret or unobserved as they might have thought. They were more judged now than they had perhaps been in the town, and the feeling began to grow. I heard comments on the bus, and more comments were reported to me by the couple who looked after the manor, that it was time for them, so noticeable, causing so many kinds of offence, to leave. From Bray, the car hire man, their near neighbour, who liked being odd man out a little himself, I heard the only thing in their favour. Bray came one evening to rescue a starling that had got into the loft of my cottage and couldn't get out again. Bray did the job easily. Then, talking of his neighbours, he said of the dairyman's elder boy, "He's very good with birds, you know." Bray was holding both his hands around the frightened, glossy, blue-black bird he had brought down, holding both heavy hands together so that the bird rested on his broad fingers and the bird's head protruded from the circle formed by his index fingers and thumbs. The two hands could have crushed the bird with one easy gesture, but only Bray's thumbs moved, stroking the bird's head, slowly, one thumb after the other, until the bird appeared to be looking about itself again. Bray, though he had turned the ground in front of his house into a motor mechanic's yard, was a countryman. His talk about birds and their habits seemed to come from his childhood, almost from another age, and I wondered how an understanding of birds, like Bray's understanding, could have come to the dairyman's son. In place of the white and red-brown pony in the paddock, there came a very tall, elegant horse. It was a famous old racehorse, I heard. I don't think its appearance in the paddock had anything to do with the dairyman. Some local landowner, perhaps even the man who, indirectly, was going to get rid of the dairyman, might have been responsible. The name of the animal and his great fame I didn't know. Nor, from simply looking at him, could I tell his great age. But he was very old. He had only a few months or weeks to live. He had come to the valley to die. He still looked muscular and glossy to me. It was like certain sportsmen or athletes who, even in age, when strength and agility have gone, retain something of the elegance of the body they trained for so long. And hearing about the fame of this animal, his triumphs and great record, I found myself indulging in anthropomorphic questions when I considered him in the paddock. Did he know who he was? Did he know where he was? Did he mind? Did he miss the crowds? I went one day to the very edge of the manor grounds to look at the horse, past the tall grass, the big spread of stacked-up wet beech leaves slowly turning to compost, the mossed-over mildewed apple trees with a glimpse of the rest of the forested orchard to one side. The old racehorse turned its head towards me in a curious way, and then I saw, with pain and nervousness, that it was blind in its left eye. As I approached, it had had to swivel its head to look at me with its bright and trusting right eye, still to me not at all like an old eye. How tall he was! And it was only now, close to it, that I saw that its coat had been glossier and more even, that its muscles had been firmer. This animal had grown used to the attentions and kindness of men. It was restful to be close to it. So much more painful, then, to see the blind side of its head. The eye had been taken out altogether, and skin had grown over the socket. The skin there was quite whole, so that on the blind side the horse's head was like sculpture. I had an oblique view from my cottage sitting room of the paddock and the water meadows beyond. The water meadows were now the cows' grazing area, and twice a day the cows came out there after milking, swaying heavily in the wet fields, and sometimes preferring to walk in the ditches. Twice or four times a day, then, calling his cows in or sending them out, the dairyman saw the old horse. The sight of the horse, noble, famous, partly blind, standing alone, had its effect on him. And he, who had mangled a spirited young pony in the same paddock, he on whom the axe was about to fall, the town from which he had been rescued was the place to which he and his family would soon have to go back, he, whose own life was so full of torment, worked himself up into a state about the abandoned horse, as he saw it, so close to death. He came to my cottage one Sunday evening. He had never come to the cottage before. Some friends had called, he said, and they had talked about the horse and the tragedy of its last days, so famous, so pampered, earner once of so much money, and now alone in a small, roughly fenced paddock, waiting for death, without crowds or acclaim. It wasn't fair, the dairyman said. It was terrible for him seeing that every day. Who were these friends he had been talking to? What kind of people? Were they his wife's friends as well? Did they come from that town where things had gone wrong for the dairyman? Did the friends know that their own friend was about to get the sack, and had they come to commiserate? Or had they just come for the day in the country? What the dairyman had come to ask, almost in tears at the end of this Sunday afternoon with his friends, was that I should help to get a book off the ground about the old racehorse, to do justice to the old animal. I gave him no encouragement. His sentimentality frightened me. It was the sentimentality of a man who could give himself the best of reasons for doing strange things. In a short time, the horse ceased to be in the paddock. It had died. Like so many deaths here, in this small village, like so many big events, it seemed to happen off stage. The winter turned unexpectedly mild. The sun came out, a kind of blossom came out. When I went for my walk, I met the dairyman coming down the hill from the barn. He smiled broadly. He had forgotten about the horse. He turned around and waved at the hillside. He said, "May in February." He didn't mean the month of May. He meant May, the blossom of the hawthorn. It was the last expression of delight in country things I heard from him. There was an element of acting about it. He was like a man living up to a role that had been given him. And he was wrong. What had come out at the top of the hill was not the hawthorn, but the blackthorn. At the top of the hill, on a long lateral lane, broken by the paved farm road and the windbreak, there was a line of these trees. It was on a section of this lane that in my earliest days I had met Jack's father-in-law and exchanged the only words I had ever exchanged with him. The morning sun struck full on these trees, on the side you saw as you came up the hill from the public road, and in the sudden mildness the trees had turned white with blossom above the black winter mud and the puddles created by the tractor wheels. The dairyman and his family left, unnoticed, quietly. 1 week they were there, noticeable, in possession of the house and garden. The next week the house felt empty, became more purely a house again, and seemed to be touched again with something of its country cottage character. And there were bigger changes. The farm manager retired. He was no longer to be seen making his rounds with his dog in the Land Rover. The farm passed into new hands, and soon there was new activity, more tractors, more farm machinery, a greater busyness. The winter that seemed to have retreated so early that year returned. At last, the true spring came. It touched Jack's garden. But, though all around was activity, on down and roadway and field lane, with tractors of new design and brighter colours, and there was no human celebration in Jack's plots of ground, nothing of the rituals I had grown to expect. The mud-spattered, autumn-clipped hedge burst into life, and the apple trees and the shrubs and the rose bushes, but there was no controlling hand now, no cutting back and tying up, no weeding, nothing done in the greenhouse, no work on the vegetable plot, scattered growths of green there, stray roots and seeds, no turning over of the earth in the bedding-out plot below the old hawthorn tree. Smoke rose from the chimney of Jack's cottage while his garden ran wild. Only the geese and ducks continued to be looked after. And all around was activity and change. The pink cottage had another couple, young people in their 20s. The man did not work in the dairy. He was a more general kind of farm worker, and he was like the other workers the new management had brought in. They were young people, these new farm workers, educated up to a point, some of them perhaps with diplomas. They dressed with care. Clothes, the new styles in clothes, were important to them. They were not particularly friendly. They might have been reflecting the seriousness and modernity of the new management, or they might have been anxious to make the point that, though they did farm workers' jobs, they were not exactly that kind of person. The man in the pink cottage had a new, or newish, car. On fine afternoons, his wife sunbathed in the ruined garden, seemingly careless of showing her breasts. She was a short woman with heavy thighs. The contemporary fashions she followed didn't flatter her figure. They made her look heavy, badly proportioned, a little absurd. But one day I saw how the long dresses of an earlier era, with high, narrow waists and full hips, might have been absolutely right for her, would have made her voluptuous. And I felt that this was how she saw herself, immensely desirable, and that this sunbathing in the wreck of the garden, this care of what had at first seemed to me a slack, heavy body, was something she might have thought she owed to her beauty. The new car, her husband's careful clothes, these were further tributes. New people, young people as well, took over the other two cottages in Jack's Row at the bottom of the valley. New brooms down there in both cottages. They swept clean. They dug up what had been left behind in both gardens, levelled the ground and planted grass. Jack's garden was wild. I saw Jack's wife outside the cottage one day. She said, talking of her new neighbours but making no gestures that might have betrayed her, "Have you seen? All lawn, my dear." The turn of speech, the irony, was a surprise. I had never thought Jack's wife capable of such things, but then I had thought of her, and she seemed to have been content to be regarded as an appendage of Jack's. "And the horses?" she said. The people in the middle cottage had a horse. I said, "How's Jack?" "He's all right, you know. He's working again." "There's a lot for him to do in the garden," she said. "You think so?" As though I had said something untrue. Why did she want to deny what was so obvious? We were standing outside the garden. Had I mentioned something she felt I shouldn't have mentioned? Was I putting a curse on the sick man? Because Jack was sick. Though she said he was working again, he was not well. And intermittently all that summer, for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, even on those sunny days which in previous years he would have celebrated by working bare-backed in his garden, the smoke rose from one of the chimneys of the cottage like a symbol of his sickness, like a sign of the cold he felt, the sick man in his room. While the new farm workers, young men with young wives, drove up and down the big fields in their new tractors, and went out in their new or newish cars after work. Jack's wife commented gently, ironically, on the changes, but she seemed more and more to accept that Jack's hold on his job, his cottage, and his garden was going, and that her own time there was coming to an end. His car stopped beside me one day. It was the first time I had seen him since the previous autumn. His face was waxen. I knew the word from books, but never till now, seeing what it described on a white face, had I truly understood the word. All the brown of Jack's face, all the sun to which he had exposed himself in his garden, had gone. His skin was white and smooth, and it seemed to have the texture and false colour of waxen fruit. It was as though a bloom, as on a plum, covered the living skin. His beard was trimmed and neat, yet even that had a waxen, even waxed, quality. Not many words, quiet words of greeting, friendship, reassurance. His obstreperous eyes were quiet, too. Wax. And the smoke came out of his cottage chimney in the autumn and in the winter. And then it stopped. The lane that led up the hill to the new barn and then down to the cottages and old farm buildings, the lane beside the windbreak of beech and pine and the subsidiary hedge of field rose and hawthorn, had grown rough and broken. You could easily have turned your ankle on it. The new farm management began to have that lane mended. Men and machines came one week, and a level black layer of mixed asphalt and gravel was quickly laid down in a few days. The black colour and the machine finish looked new and unnatural next to the tufted grass of the verges. But the surface that had been so quickly laid down was meant to last. As if in pledge of that, the yellow board of the roadmakers was set up on the public road just before the lane, and one end of the board was cut into a directional arrow. I didn't like the change. I felt it threatened what I had found and what I had just begun to enter. I didn't like the new busyness, the new machines, the machine lopping of the hawthorn and wild rose which left them looking damaged, and I didn't want that new surface on the farm lane to hold. I looked for cracks and flaws in it and hoped that the little abrasions and water erosions I noticed would spread and make it impossible, fantasy taking over from logic, for the machines to lay down a new asphalt mixture. Of course, I knew my fantasy was fantasy, though the farm was set among ruins of many sorts, reminders of the impermanence of men's doings. There was another side to men's work. Men came back, men went on, men did, and did again. How small the caravels were that crossed the Atlantic and intruded into the evenness of history on the other side. How few the men in those small vessels. How limited their means. How barely noticed. But they went back. They changed the world in that part forever. So though the new asphalt layer was crushed here and there into dips by the tractor wheels, and though the rain running down the hill sought out every weakness and crack in the dips and dug out minute bits of asphalt from between small stones, and then dug more deeply into the loosened surface, and the irregular edge of the surface was undermined by water running down in little channels, miniatures of the larger channels of which our valley was a relic, between the hard black crust and the soft grass-covered earth, though there were these things that made me feel that the lane might be reduced again to the rocky, uneven condition in which I had first found it, yet the lane was made good, and then made good again, and withstood the winter, which came fiercely that year. There was a blizzard on Christmas Day, with the wind blowing from the northwest. I found, when I went out in the early afternoon, that the snow had been blown into a drift in the windbreak, a bank of snow then beside the lane, and in the lee of every tree trunk, every sturdy twig, every obstacle, there was a sharp ridge that indicated the direction of the wind. The shape and texture of this snowdrift reminded me of a climate quite different, of a Trinidad beach where shallow streams, fresh water mingled with salt, salt predominating or lessening according to the tides, ran from tropical woodland to the sea. These streams rose and subsided with the tide. Water flowed now from the sea to the pools of the woodland river, now in the other direction. At every low tide the streams cut fresh channels in the freshly laid sand, created fresh sand cliffs, which then, when the tide began to rise again, fell neatly, segment by clean segment, into the rippled current, a geography lesson in miniature. To me as a child these streams always brought to mind the beginning of the world before men, before the settlement. Romance and ignorance, for though there were no longer Aboriginal people on the island, they had been there for millennia. So the texture and shapes and patterns of the snow here on the down in the windbreak and in its lee created in small the geography of great countries, like the little rivulets that ran between the steep grass verge and the new asphalt crust of the lane. And this geography in miniature was set, as I thought, or as I liked to think, in a vaster geography. The valley of the Droveway between the smooth low hills spoke of vast rivers hundreds of yards across, flowing here in some age now unimaginably remote, a geography whose scale denied the presence of men. There would have been a brimming river, or flow, all the way from Stonehenge, and the plain beyond, to Jack's cottage, and then along the Droveway with the beehives and the caravan and stone shell of a house and farm manager's bungalow and suburban-style garden. There would have been a river, all there, a flat, grey flow, debouching into or filling the valley of the present river, a remnant, small-scale, human, beside which I sometimes walked, and where people now fished for trout, released by keepers. In that vast geography, created by the miniature landscape and the fantasy of the Droveway as river channel, there was no room for men. That vision was a vision of the world before men. Beyond the brow of the hill the wind was keen. Shelter was no longer provided by the hill or the windbreak. A livid grey sky, a grey but warm dirtiness, hung over the great plain, where the barrows were like pimples, the stone circles lost in the snow, blurring the view at the edges, no sight of the coloured artillery targets. At the bottom of the hill, among the farm buildings, made monumental by the snowfall, was the dead cottage of Jack. Snow lying on the ground about it, the Droveway there normally so muddy and black, like a great clean thing, like a remaking of the world. The snow made for hard walking, but weather like this, in this usually mild valley, revived in me a wish for extremes, though it was the cold and the damp and the wet, that had carried away Jack. His damaged lungs in that damp valley bottom had denied him warmth even in the summer. Something else, of course, if there had been no cold or damp, would have carried him away. On my early walks, after having my fill of the henge and the barrows, I had looked for hares on one slope. Then, on another hill, at another season, I had looked for larks, trying to keep them in sight as they rose and rose, lift upon lift, and watching for them as they dropped down. Now I looked for deer. A family of three had appeared in the valley, coming from no one knew where, and surviving in our well-tilled, well-grazed valley, dangerous over large tracts, with military gunfire, crossed at many places by busy highways, surviving among us, no one knew how. The deer had their run, too, and it was in the hope of seeing them, in addition to my excitement at the snow and the wind, that I tramped round the farm buildings and up the droveway to the point from which there was a view of the wood and the unfilled open slope where the deer sometimes grazed. And unbelievably, my Christmas reward, they were there, in the snow. Usually against the wood, the deer were hard to see. Lower down, against the chalky green and brown of the bare slope, they were reddish-brown, warm, but they had to be looked for. Now, like the rabbits of my very first week, coming out to feed on the lawn in front of my cottage, the deer were dirty-looking, grey, dark against the snow, easy marks for anyone who wished to knock them off. I longed for those deer to survive, and they did. Towards the end of the winter, I discovered one in the wilderness at the back of my cottage, in the marshland beside the river. He was a young deer, and I caught sight of him one morning, all eyes, among the beaten-down brown reeds. And there, for many mornings in succession, I saw him. I stood on the rotting bridge over the Black Creek and looked. The secret, then, to see him, to keep him where he was to hold his eyes and to be still oneself. As long as you looked, he looked. As soon as you moved or made a gesture, he was away, running at first through the reeds and tall grass, and then giving the lovely leap that could take him clear over fences and hedges. The spring came. The new surface of the lane up the hill held. The new life of the farm continued. And for the second year running, Jack's cottage and garden were apart from the activity. His death, his funeral, like the death and funeral of his father-in-law some years before, seemed to have happened secretly. One of the effects of the country life, the dark road, the scattered houses, the big views. His vegetable plot, overrun with weeds, was barely noticeable. His fruit and flower garden grew more wild, the hedge and the rose bushes growing out. His greenhouse at the back, really the front, became empty. So much that had looked traditional, natural, emanations of the landscape, things that country people did, the planting out of annuals, the tending of the geese, the clipping of the hedge, the pruning of the fruit trees, now turned out not to have been traditional or instinctive after all, but to have been part of Jack's way. When he wasn't there to do these things, they weren't done. There was only a ruin. The new people in the other cottages didn't do what he had done. They seemed to have little regard for their bit of cottage land, or they saw it differently. Or they had another idea of their lives. The first year of Jack's illness, Jack's wife had pretended that nothing had changed, that Jack's garden was still a garden. Now she didn't pretend. She was making ready to leave, and she was doing so in a matter-of-fact way, as though, after all, in spite of appearances, in spite of the antique ways of her father, in spite of Jack, little had been invested by her in that cottage, the life attached to it, and those years of the garden. She now had no connection with the farm or the land. The local council was going to find a house or flat for her on a housing estate in the valley, or in one of the nearby towns, Amesbury, Salisbury, Shrewton, Great Wishford, or elsewhere. She would meet more people, she would be nearer the shops. She was looking forward to the move. The traditional life at the bottom of the valley, in the mud and damp around the farm, far from people, where you were shut up for the evening if you didn't have a car, the traditional life hadn't been to her taste. Still, she thought that Jack had had a good life. She said, "On the Christmas Eve he got up and went to the pub, you know. He knew he was going to die, and he knew it was his last chance." She spoke quite casually, giving me this news, now more than a year old. She was just making conversation. She said, He wanted to be with his friends for the last time. To be with his friends. To enjoy the last drink. To have the final sweetness of life as he knew it. What an effort it would have taken. To have those blocks of ice for lungs, to be incapable of getting warm, to be fatigued and faint, to want nothing more than to lie down and close one's eyes and sail away into the fantasies that were claiming one. And yet he had roused himself, and found the energy to dress, and had driven to the pub for the holiday before his death. Did he drive along the lane, up and down the hill, beside the windbreak? Or did he, because it required less judgment, drive along the wide, rutted droveway? That way, along the droveway, would have been more likely to get him to the pub and back. But it would have shaken him up dreadfully, as I had seen him in another mood, shaken up one spring or summer Sunday afternoon, when his shout had been touched with beer. That final trip to the pub served no cause except that of life. Yet he made it appear an act of heroism. Poetical. Across the lawn from my cottage there was a small old flint building. It was covered with ivy, and the ivy was so thick and firm that pigeons roosted in it. The building was square in plan and had a pyramidal roof. This roof appeared to be open at the apex, and above that, on four stilts, was a second, miniature roof of the same pyramidal shape. I was told that the building had been a granary, or storehouse, and that it was some centuries old. It was not used now. I never saw anyone go into it. It was preserved for its beauty and as something from the past. Not far from it, and still on the far side of the lawn, was a building that pretended to be a rough old farmhouse. Its walls were made up of bits of brick and stone and flint, the mixture suggesting rubble, peasant pickings. It was about 50 years old and had been put up as one of the ancillary buildings of the manor, a fives court or squash court, but built in this picturesque way to suit the setting. Perhaps it had been used as a squash court for some time. But its front door permanently closed, its corrugated iron roof sagging in places, some of the glass panes of its windows fallen out, it had no function now, had had none for many years. Like the boathouse on the riverbank, like the round two-story children's house with a conical thatched roof in the overgrown orchard. The life of the manor had altered. The organization had shrunk. Needs that had once ramified as if to match the resources and organization of the big house had not been permanent. The manor, too, had its ruins. Between granary and mock farmhouse, and beyond the manor wall, was the church. To me, in the beginning, a church was a church, something built in a particular way, with windows of a particular shape, ideas given me by the Victorian Gothic churches I had seen in Trinidad. But I had that village church before my eyes every day, and quite soon, this new world shaping itself about me in my lucky solitude, I saw that the church was restored, and architecturally was as artificial as the farmhouse. Once that was seen, it was seen. The church radiated its own mood, the mood of its Victorian Edwardian restorers. I saw the church not as church, but as part of the wealth and security of Victorian Edwardian times. It was like the manor to which my cottage was attached, like many of the other big houses around. The church stood on a pre-medieval site. That was what was said, but little about the church as it now was had come down from that time. Not a piece of flint, not a slab of dressed stone that framed the Gothic windows, and perhaps not even the faith was old. Just as it was hard to imagine the lives and religious impulses of the people who had, with immense labour, turned this plain into a burial ground and preserved its sanctity for centuries, so it was hard, though one stood on the very ground and was exposed to the same weather, but not now the same dawns or sunsets, always the vapour trails of aircraft, to enter into the spirit, the terrors and the need for redemption, of the people who had worshipped 1,000 years before in the first Christian church on this site, that lay so close to me just across the lawn and beyond the Play farmhouse. Play farmhouse, renovated church. Had that been a kind of play, too? The religion of the renovated church? Did the renovators share the old terrors? Or was this faith something quite different, something touched with the sense of history, the assurance of continuity, the sense of something owed to oneself. When you looked down on the plain from the viewing point in the windbreak on the hill, you could see Stonehenge to the west and the beginnings of the town of Amesbury to the east. The River Avon ran through Amesbury. There were chapels and abbeys here, too, beside the river, wide and shallow at this point. Amesbury, now a military town with little modern houses and shops and garages, was an old place. It was to a nunnery in Amesbury that Guinevere, Arthur's queen, the lover of Lancelot, had retired when the Round Table had vanished from Camelot, all of 20 miles away at Winchester. A sign on the road from Stonehenge, just before you entered Amesbury, celebrated the antiquity of the town with a coat of arms and a date, A.D. 979. The historical feeling that had caused that sign to be put up had also brought about the restoration of the chapels and abbeys of Amesbury, as well as of the church that lay across the lawn from my own cottage. History, like religion, or like an extension of religion, as an idea of one's own redemption and glory. Yet there was an uncelebrated darkness before the foundation of that town of Amesbury in A.D. 979, as recorded by the sign. More than 500 years before that, the Roman army had left Britain, and Stonehenge had been built and had fallen into ruin, and the vast burial ground had lost its sanctity long before the Romans had come. So that history, here, where there were so many ruins and restorations, seemed to be plateaus of light, with intervening troughs or disappearances into darkness. We lived still on one such plateau of historical light. Amesbury, founded A.D. 979. History, glory, religion as a wish to do the right thing by oneself. These ideas were still with some people in the valleys roundabout, though there had been some diminution in personal glory. And the new houses and gardens were like the small change of the great estates of the last century and the beginning of this century. These people, though they had come, many of them, from other places, still had the idea of being successors and inheritors. It was because of this idea of historical inheritance and succession that many new people in our valley went to the restored church. The church had been restored for people like them. It met their needs. In this they were different from Bray, the car-hire man, who had lived all his life in the valley. Bray never went to the church and was scornful of the motives of those who did. And the churchgoers were also different from Jack, who had lived the best part of his life in the cottage over the hill and, while he was vigorous, had celebrated the seasons with rituals of his own. On Sundays, Jack worked in the morning in his garden and went to the pub at noon. In the afternoon, he worked again in his garden. The church stood on an old site. I could believe that. Beyond the churchyard, and more or less hidden by the church itself, the old flint churchyard wall and trees on the other side, were the sheds and buildings of the dairy. Did they also stand on an old site? I had no trouble believing that they did, because the world, in places like this, is never absolutely new. There is always something that has gone before. Shrine or sacred place before church, farm before farm, on the site of an old ford set in a wood, first Walden, then Shore, then Waldenshaw, a hamlet between the water meadows and the flinty downs, a hamlet one of many on the river highway. New to the valley, overwhelmed by the luck of the near solitude, I had found in this historical part of England the solitude that had done away with my stranger's nerves. I had seen everything as a kind of perfection, perfectly evolved, but I had hardly begun to look. The land and its life had hardly begun to shape itself about me when things began to change. And I had fallen back on old ideas, ideas now not so much of decay as of flux and the constancy of change, to fight the distress I felt at everything, a death, a fence, a departure, that undid or altered or threatened the perfection I had found. It could have been said that the perfection of the house in whose grounds I lived had been arrived at 40 or 50 years before, when the Edwardian house was still fairly new, its family life fuller, when the ancillary buildings had a function and the garden was looked after. But in that perfection, occurring at a time of empire, there would have been no room for me. The builder of the house and the designer of the garden could not have imagined, with their world view, that at a later time someone like me would have been in the grounds, and that I would feel I was having the place, the cottage, the empty picturesque houses around the lawn, the grounds, the wild gardens, at its peak, living in a beauty that hadn't been planned for. I liked the decay, such as it was. It gave me no wish to prune or weed or set right or remake. It couldn't last, clearly. But while it lasted, it was perfection. To see the possibility, the certainty of ruin, even at the moment of creation, it was my temperament. Those nerves had been given me as a child in Trinidad, partly by our family circumstances, the half-ruined or broken-down houses we lived in, our many moves, our general uncertainty. Possibly, too, this mode of feeling went deeper, and was an ancestral inheritance, something that came with the history that had made me, not only India, with its ideas of a world outside men's control, but also the colonial plantations or estates of Trinidad, to which my impoverished Indian ancestors had been transported in the last century, estates of which this Wiltshire estate, where I now lived, had been the apotheosis. 50 years ago there would have been no room for me on the estate. Even now my presence was a little unlikely, but more than accident had brought me here, or rather, in the series of accidents that had brought me to the manor cottage with a view of the restored church, there was a clear historical line. The migration within the British Empire from India to Trinidad had given me the English language as my own, and a particular kind of education. This had partly seeded my wish to be a writer in a particular mode, and had committed me to the literary career I had been following in England for 20 years. The history I carried with me, together with the self-awareness that had come with my education and ambition, had sent me into the world with a sense of glory dead, and in England had given me the rawest, stranger's nerves. Now, ironically, or aptly, living in the grounds of this shrunken estate, going out for my walks, those nerves were soothed, and in the wild garden and orchard beside the water meadows I found a physical beauty perfectly suited to my temperament, and answering, besides, every good idea I could have had, as a child in Trinidad, of the physical aspect of England. The estate had been enormous, I was told. It had been created in part by the wealth of empire, but then bit by bit it had been alienated. The family in its many branches flourished in other places. Here in the valley there now lived only my landlord, elderly, a bachelor, with people to look after him. Certain physical disabilities had now been added to the malaise which had befallen him years before, a malaise of which I had no precise knowledge, but interpreted as something like acedia, the monk's torpor, or disease of the Middle Ages, which was how his great security, his excessive worldly blessings, had taken him. The acedia had turned him into a recluse, accessible only to his intimate friends, so that on the manor itself, as on my walks on the down, I had a kind of solitude. I felt a great sympathy for my landlord. I felt I could understand his malaise. I saw it as the other side of my own. I did not think of my landlord as a failure. Words like failure and success didn't apply. Only a grand man, or a man with a grand idea of his human worth, could ignore the high money value of his estate and be content to live in its semi-ruin. My meditations in the manor were not of imperial decline. Rather, I wondered at the historical chain that had brought us together. He in his house, I in his cottage, the wild garden, his taste, as I was told, and also mine. I knew that the life I had in the manor grounds was temporary and couldn't last. The future was so easy to see, a hotel or school or foundation taking over the big house and setting the decayed grounds to rights— grounds where I now walked with such pleasure, and for the first time in my adult life, and more as my knowledge increased, felt in tune with the natural world. I dreaded change both here and on the droveway, and that was why, meeting distress halfway, I cultivated old, possibly ancestral, ways of feeling, the ways of glory dead, and held on to the idea of a world in flux, the drum of creation in the god's right hand, the flame of destruction in his left. So, for a week or more, I balanced between the two things, anxiety, the idea of flux, when I heard from beyond the churchyard the sound of a bulldozer, or something like it, The noise travelled through the ground in vibrations. It was not a noise that a window could shut out. The cowsheds and dairy buildings beyond the churchyard were being pulled down. Structures of clay tiles and red brick, that had been so much part of the view as I came down the hill at the end of my walk, so natural and right that I had not paid them too much attention. Now, with the sheds gone, the ground looked naked and ordinary, and the water meadows at the back were exposed, and the trees on the river bank. The clay tiles from the roofs were stacked up, the roof timbers were stacked up, and how new they looked, though the buildings had seemed to me so old. And then, very quickly, the open view was blocked out again with a wide, prefabricated shed with slatted timber walls, and with the printed name of the shed makers on a board or metal plate just below the apex of the roof. A shed like this, but without the slatted walls, had been put up one or two owners or managers before, at the edge of the old farmyard over the hill, and not far from Jack's cottage, to store hay, to replace the cottage-shaped hayrick covered with black plastic sheeting on the driveway. That hayrick now mouldering away, the black plastic itself weathered, without its lustre and tension, no longer crackling when it flapped, its texture now rather like the skin of very old people, like a faded rose petal. Change. New ideas, new efficiency. Before, on the roadside, at the entrance to the dairy yard, there had been a wooden platform where the milk churns were placed, set at that height to be easily picked up by the milk van or truck. There were to be no churns now. There were to be refrigerated tanks, and milk was to be collected by tanker. Next to the metal-walled barn at the top of the hill, another prefabricated cowshed was set up, and next to that, a modern milking building. This milking building, or milking parlour, quaint word, was a mechanical-looking affair. Its concrete floor, set in a sloping field, looked like a concrete platform. It had pipes and meters and gauges, and the men who worked the parlour who corralled the dung-stained cattle into the pens or channels had something of the grimness of industrial workers. They drove up to the milking parlour in brightly coloured cars, the colours noticeable up there against the soft colours of the downs, green and brown and chalk, and in the winter the blurred darkness of stripped trees. These cars, when parked, helped to make the milking parlour and the barn and the new prefabricated shed look like a little factory at the top of the hill. The parlour hissed mechanically, electrically, but the new prefabricated shed gave off a smell of dung. Some of the earth excavated for the foundations of the parlour had been dumped between the parlour and the paved lane. In this area, waste ground, grass grew thick and green, with a scattering of weeds and stray wheat. The brightly coloured cars, the hum and hiss of the milking machine, the cows, even with their dung, reduced to machine-managed objects, the tense young men, conscious of their style, their jeans and shirts, their moustaches and cars, they were all aspects of the new, exaggerated thing that had come upon us. Twice a day the milk tanker went grinding up the hill, up the resurfaced lane, to empty the refrigerated milk tanks of the new milking parlour. With the farm tractors and the motor cars of the new workers, my walk in the lane beside the windbreak was at times like a walk on a public road. I had to watch for traffic. On the public road, the thatched cottage with the pink walls and the straw pheasant on the ridge of the roof lost a little more of its first character. So pretty, so like a postcard when I had first seen it, so like something one had always known, with its rose hedge and its small polished windows. The dairyman would have loved it too, I am certain, but, like me at the beginning, he would have seen its beauty as a natural attribute of the country setting, and he had lived in the house as he might have lived in a house in the town from which he had come, without any feeling that anything was owed to the house in which he and his family lived, having all his life considered houses, even those in which he lived, as belonging to other people. Basins and pots and pans and bits of paper and tins and empty boxes had been left out in the garden, and some of those things had stayed there even after the dairyman and his family had gone. Now part of the hedge and the wire fence were taken down, so that the car of the new couple could be parked off the public road. The car was important to the new people, more important than the house. They were young people, without children, and they handled the house in a new way. It was a place of shelter, no more. Temporary shelter for a temporary job. The wife sunbathed in the front garden whenever she could, and perhaps this was why the front door was often open. That open front door was very unsettling. The house as a place of shelter, not as a place to which you could transfer, or risk transferring, emotion or hopes. This attitude of the new couple to the thatched house seemed to match the more general new attitude to the land.